WKAR. Welcome to MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4, following the latest BBC News, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis will introduce you to brand new MSU ice hockey coach Danton Cole. And we'll learn all about our mobility future in autonomous and connected vehicles from MSU Engineering Professor Haider Rita.
I mean, if you look at the potential benefits of autonomous driving, it's just really phenomenal. I mean, you could start from safety, where you could really save literally worldwide maybe about a million life a year.
MSU Today begins at 4:06. WKAR. This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with the Spartans' brand new ice hockey coach, Danton Cole.
Well, it's a real pleasure to introduce Danton Cole, our new MSU ice hockey coach, and a Spartan through and through, a winner at all levels, and just someone that I know that you would like your child to be around, because he's been a teacher, not simply a person who does X's and O's. And so, Dan, it's really great to have you. I think we're about the 3-week mark of having a green paycheck, because you've always been green throughout your career. So welcome.
It's been a busy 3 weeks for you as well.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. We've had Big Ten meetings and NCAA meetings, so the weeks have been broken up a little bit. So we've been here for a couple of days, then gone and back. But it's been good. It seems fairly productive. The guys are all leaving this week, so we've been trying to mix in having meetings with them, and got on the ice for an hour with them. So that was fun. That was it was nice to just to get out on the ice, and that's what you want to do at the end of the day. So
tell the listeners about that experience, first time you stepped blades to the ice in Munn Ice Arena as a head coach of the Spartans.
Yeah, it was an interesting feeling. I think it wasn't quite as weird as going into Mason's office and sitting down, but that was, or at least on that side of the desk. But it was a good feeling. You know, you jump out there, and I think there's always memories and emotions kind of pop back, and the guys are zipping around. So it was a lot of fun. I was glad I could do it. I wanted to, you know, make a little bit of an impression and set a little bit of a, I don't know if you want to say impact or statement of how we're going to do things, maybe not so much physically, but just mentally get after things. And the guys were great. They were real attentive, and it was a good hour.
It's unfortunate that, you know, because of the timing of all of this, there's not more time, but I'm sure you gave them a homework assignment.
Yeah, well, there's a few things. You know, the workouts are going to be really important, and how they come back will determine how we can play. And we're going to meet tonight and go over a few things. And Mike Vorkopek will give them their summer workouts. And that's, you know, the discipline and self belief and things that they have to have for us to be really good. That's going to be on them quite a bit. You know, in terms of, you know, we can't check up or test on them over the summer. You know, they can, you know, we can chat with them, but we'll see where they come back, and hopefully they understand that. But there's definitely a few things that we want to go over, and Coach Mason used to say that, you know, if you guys show up in shape, we can start working on stuff right away, and that'll be, hey, for us moving forward, that'll be really, really important.
Just recently I had the opportunity to go down and tour the new arena in Detroit, Little Caesars Arena, and talk with some of the front office down there about what that rink means to attracting pro players in the game of ice hockey. They're talking about almost a recruiting type philosophy of having to attract the wives, the kids, as well as the players, and having amenities. I argue Munn Ice Arena is perhaps one of the finest rinks out there from inside the bowl, playing the game, the atmosphere. But when you look at some of the opportunities that we're striving for in what student athletes need today, I guess, close within the rink, what are some of those amenities that you think are important?
Yeah, it's interesting how things have changed. And, you know, it used to be, like you're saying, just, you know, this is the ice arena and then the crowd, and that was kind of it. Now it's, you know, it's a lot bigger picture. And, you know, I think one of the bigger things is that's changed a lot is you guys used to come to school and it was, hey, this is MSU's a great place and come here for 4 years and have a chance to win a championship. And now everybody looks kind of at that next stage and where it's at, and development is a huge thing. And they all want to play in the NHL, even though, you know, mathematically it's hard to do, but to give themselves that chance, that's what they're really looking for. And, you know, from a teaching and a training aspect, you know, just the weight room would be huge, you know, and adding that and having that right in-house for us there. I mean, obviously the football building is a great setup, but having that there, having the teaching rooms, having the space available in the locker room, and like I said, being able to develop and to get better as a player and having that chance, whether it's on ice or off ice. And it's something that young men are looking at and their families.
Yeah, I think, and I heard the same message down there. As you look at Munn, very conveniently located at the Academic Center, which gives an opportunity to train, not only academically, but for life, the experiences that they're going to need once they've moved on from either Michigan State or those that are fortunate enough to play pro hockey. But to have some of those amenities that we can add are extremely important to the future of the program, future of the student-athletes, and that's what they're competing against. So we're off to work on that one right now. As well.
Yeah, no, things are moving, and the Spartan Fun guys are doing a great job.
I think for me, the word amenities, I still struggle with. Mm-hmm. Because I think that we always have known that polishing and making sure that mental, physical went together. It goes back to Plato and Socrates and a whole philosophy of why sport is important. And I think what we have now is a world with students that they feel their time is very compressed.
Right.
And it's a generation of compressed time. Mm-hmm. And so having things that are, you're able to almost multitask and integrate the work with other things becomes more and more important in a modern world. Where having them scattered into the football building was fine because the equipment's top shelf, the people are great. But it doesn't deal with that sort of multitasking integration that becomes important, that you can work on multiple things within a short period of time. I do worry that for all of our sports, as this becomes more the norm, that the interaction across sports that's been a real strength of a university program as opposed to a minor league hockey program will be lost, and we have to then purposefully find ways to get our students mixing up together besides just a leadership council or a project.
And that's really been a desire expressed by student-athletes that have the opportunity to engage. Joe Cox was mm-hmm. on a council that is striving for not only interaction among different teams, where I think many would assume they all know each other very closely, and they don't. But really with the whole student body of finding ways where student-athletes can engage with fellow students as well. I think they're important. There's many institutions that have gone on to build the custom cafeteria that is one of isolation that we have not here and have not deliberately in many cases. But it's I think there's a lot to be said for that. It's going to Michigan State is a transition in life from childhood to adulthood, and the more experiences and the more interactions that you can get, I think, are extremely healthy for today's students.
And that'll be part of sort of the neat thing about being here is the opportunity to interact and push interactions beyond what might be in Munn Ice Arena. So I think it's going to be I think it's great for our coaches and not simply for our student athletes.
No, it's a, you know, that, as you guys are saying, it's a societal thing. I mean, even talking to, you know, and all of us that are parents and trying to engage and interact even with our kids at home is hard now. Everyone, you know, they're hunched over their phones at almost all times, and you would think with all the technology and information we have at our hands that would open up more time. But I think it's it's created a situation where it seems like there's an awful lot less time. And I think that's imperative for the coaches and the leaders to make sure that the guys are interacting. And even if it's a situation where we do it a lot at our meals where, you know, the phones are off and slide them to the middle of the table, no phones. I mean, as simple a thing as that can change a dynamic. And having guys, I always look back and we moved off campus after my first year and 20 years later, I said, you know, I didn't meet a lot of new people once I moved off campus. And I was like, the people in Wonders were great. There were some friends, fortunately, we kept. But I was always like, I wish I would have stayed one more year in the dorms because I would have been a little older and probably a little smarter and been able to meet people more at home. And but I think you have to keep pushing on those things and you have to keep educating. And because it is, like Mark was saying, it's a part of growing up. And there are other people in the world and there's some fascinating people in the world. Get out and meet them.
You've been to these national meetings on hockey. You commented earlier. Any changes that people can anticipate in the sport next year?
It's not a rule change year, so I think there was a lot of theory discussed down there, which sometimes leads to not much getting done. But I think where some things you'll see off the ice, we've been talking about some recruiting things and trying to get it away from being so young, which I think some of the other sports have made some advancements on, and to get away from the 8th and 9th grade commitments, because I don't think that's healthy for anyone. You know, talked about the NLI a lot. Susan Peel from the NCAA was there and did a great job with that. On ice, you know, video seems to be the real big thing, and, you know, how much do we review? What do we review? I think that we might tweak with the rules a little bit. There might be some things, but I think video is the main thing. Are we going to go to more and more reviews and slow the game down more and more?
When the president pushes the button or the athletic director.
Maybe that's
We'd like to call something.
We'd like to look at that one.
We'll see if we can get a challenge flag up there, right. One extra one per game. I'd like to see a little less of it in the delays and the goals. We want to get them right, but I think there's also something to the flow of the game. I think it takes away from the game. There's a human element to everything we have, and there is something to the pace of the game that I really enjoy.
Football and basketball talk a lot about length of games. It's when you talk about today's culture, it is an immediate culture. It's people want things in shorter time frames. Has that been a discussion as well at the meetings about length of hockey games?
It comes up quite often, and you know. But then at the same time, then the discussion after is, well, we should have, you know, one more timeout and one more challenge. And so, you know, you have to make the trade off is there. But I think everyone's cognizant of it, and I'd like to see it as close to 2 hours as we can, and it's doable. We had some tests in the AHL a few years ago where we did the hurry-up face-offs, and we were getting out of games in an hour and 50 minutes, and the problem with those is then it's slow. You know, coaches, they take advantage of certain things and start dragging it out, and all of a sudden you're back to 2 hours and 15, 2 hours and 20 minutes. So they talk about it, and I think they're real conscious when we're looking at the video replays and the things that you want to add. And the NCAA games got real long. I think some of those took almost 3 hours. You start doing three timeouts a period. So everybody's looking at ways to speed it up, and hopefully that stays on their mind.
As coach of the USA development team, you brought home gold medals. You coached some young kids that are probably at the very, very top of their game. And what did you pull out of that USA development that will transition into the head hockey coaching job here?
Yeah, there's a lot of lessons there. It's I've talked a lot about it in the last little while about how fascinating a place is to coach, and just, you know, the level of guys you have there, but how much they need to learn, and you're almost, the first year is incredible because you're always at a deficit, and out of the 55 games you play, the 15 international ones are really the ones where you go in and say, you know, we're probably favored, or, you know, you have a good game, you'll probably win. The other ones against, you know, kids that are 3 and 4 year men, they're 3 and 4 years older than you. You're really going in that, you know, you have to get good goaltending, get a couple breaks. Everyone has to play well, and then you have to get lucky to win a game. That's an odd situation for a coach to be in, but from a learning environment, we talk to our athletes a lot, and I think coaches give a lot of good advice. I don't think they always listen to their own advice, but, you know, dealing with that struggle and really, you know, diving down into, okay, how are we teaching? How do we want to progress? How to have a one-year plan and a two-year plan and sticking with it and not varying away from it. So I think as a coach, it was really, really good for me, regardless of how talented they were, just how much you have to teach, how you have to teach, how kids learn, and how you build a team and to get through through some of those things and developing a culture. Fortunately, there's a really good one there. We're constantly trying to change it. So there's a lot of life lessons. And then on top of that, something that you had mentioned earlier too is getting through to these guys. You know, that there's going to be a lot of high draft picks. Almost all those guys are gonna play. My first group, I think 17 of the 22 have signed NHL deals. Mm-hmm. There's probably only five that aren't going to have to work again. I say we're making real money playing pro hockey. That means there's 17 of them. That's a vast majority of them are going to have to do something else in life and developing that. And you really get an appreciation after a few years of, you know, seeing where guys are at and seeing them grow up and kind of understand that and, you know, being okay with what they've accomplished, but also understand there's a heck of a lot more to life than hockey.
You would probably, as a college hockey coach, take that proportion for your team here.
Oh, I'd love it. Yeah, that we'd be in great shape. It'd be interesting, and you know, hopefully that'll be where it is that we do have some guys going to the NHL, and then those guys. I'd like to start getting more of those guys back on campus in the summer. It was something we all used to do, and I've talked to a lot of alums about it. Where we always said, where else would you want to go train? But you know, you go back there, we'd have 20 NHL guys and 20 guys from MSU skating in the summer. So every day you'd have great skates and you'd lift and you'd go golf and some of us took some classes after we were done and finishing up. But it was an unbelievable atmosphere and again, the transference of that and that culture and that's what you want to have.
And I think you've had influence on and coach more than 80 guys that have gone on to the NHL. You've raised the Stanley Cup yourself. So I would suspect folks are going to listen on the team about what it takes, what the difference is, where the gap is, and what really needs to be done for those that have that skill set to be able to play. But also, one of the great attractions was the feeling that I had about your ability to develop people as people. And I look forward to watching both of those experiences as we move ahead.
Yeah, it's just great to have you back. The more we continue to learn about you and all that you've accomplished, the enthusiasm just continued to grow. And I know this is going to be a hard transition, not because of skill or talent or passion but we just have to get a culture back in the hockey program that believes in the same things that you do.
Yeah, well, no, it's hey, it's been great. I can't tell you how easy it's been. You know, people are saying, you know, overwhelmed, this and that. And I've been saying that it's been busy but not rushed. The people around here have been outstanding. There's tons of help. Everyone's on board. The other coaches, you know, like Jake Boss popped by today. And I know you're having Stacy on later on. We exchanged texts last week. Just everybody's been really gracious and helpful. And that'll get us down the line a lot quicker. So it's been outstanding. And like you said, I'm excited and just want to keep moving here.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Danton. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was MSU's brand new ice hockey coach, Danton Cole, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear the conversation again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today. This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Broadcasting from the campus of Michigan State University, this is 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR.
She's up all night to the sun. I'm up all night to get some. She's up all night for good fun. I'm up all night to get
WKAR.
Maybe you can drive my car.
This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Engineering Professor Haider Rida for a conversation on our mobility future in autonomous and connected vehicles.
Haider Rida, is one of our superstar faculty members in electrical and computer engineering. And it's one of the faculty members that for a while just does really great stuff in their area. And all of a sudden, the area becomes super hot. And now you're a star of radio programs and teams, coaching teams for international competition, and in such high demand as we think about looking at the Canvas, which is our connected and autonomous networked vehicles for active safety Canvas project. So what's the difference between a connected vehicle and an autonomous vehicle? What's that difference mean?
Great question. So really we have these two different technology areas that are emerging rather independently right now. So one of them has to do with autonomous vehicles. And autonomous vehicle is basically a vehicle that could sense, perceive, and maneuver around its environment without being connected to other vehicles, without communicating with the other vehicles. So that's pretty much the primary focus of the industry and a lot of the research going on in academia right now. Now, then we have this another universe, if you will. It's the universe of connected vehicles, where vehicles could communicate and send messages to each other. Those vehicles could be driven by human driver, just like, you know, today. So the messages could serve to warn human drivers that other vehicle going to come, you know, across an intersection, for example. Now, the technology associated with connected vehicles, which basically rely a lot on the same technology we use for wireless communication and Wi-Fi that we have, you know, in our, you know, very commonly in our places. So that technology actually is very mature, and in fact, there is a standard, and NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, have made issued a recommendation for automotive companies to embrace and support this connected vehicle technology within, let's say, 4 or 5 years. So that's going on, and we hope, in fact, that's one of the things that we're trying to do within Canvas, is to bring these two technology areas together, because they will be significantly more powerful together than, you know, being developed on their own.
We were talking before we came on air about some national competitions that our students are taking place in.
Yeah.
Talk about those students. They're here training. They're having unbelievable hands-on experience in this design work. When they're done at Michigan State, where do those students go on to in order to gain employment?
Well, for one thing, we're actually trying hard to recruit them for graduate school.
Okay. Keep them here.
We try to keep them as long as we can. In fact, I mentioned some of the students who are participating in the NHTSA International Competition, and they will be they're representing MSU, and of course MSU is one of the three schools will be representing North America.
When a student group, you work with students, these are undergraduate and graduate students, and so part of their project is to learn to not take things from the classroom and put it into practice. So what is their project? What did they demonstrate that got them into this international competition? What did they do?
It's a very inspiring and amazing story, frankly. Those students actually in the NHTSA competition. So we have two competitions.
Okay.
So one of them is the NHTSA competition, which has to do with enhanced vehicle safety, ESV. So that's an international competition, and NHTSA go through multiple phases where they select schools who should be part of the competition from each continent based on proposals, and then they go another round where they actually interview and meet with the students, and the students need to demonstrate some kind of prototype about some of their ideas, and then they will select the finalists. So that's one competition. We have another competition, which is sponsored by GM and the Society for Automotive Engineers, SAE. That competition, also very highly selective, was announced last year. And then GM and SAE, just a couple of weeks ago, they actually announced 8 schools from North America to compete over 3 years. This is a long-term competition, and MSU is one of those 8 schools.
But what would be part of the project? What does the project look like? I do a prototype to have a car not crash into one another, or to figure out that there's really snow underneath me and not pavement or gravel? What's sort of the what did they do?
Right. So let's start from actually some of the graduate level type of research. So there we're really trying to focus on a lot of compelling and challenging problems that industry, frankly, are not looking at right now. We're looking really beyond, mm-hmm. you know, many of the things that the industry is very much focusing on right now. So an example is what I call it is lineless driving. A lot of the technology for autonomous vehicle, including, for example, some of the early ones adopted by Tesla, for example, was basically based on detecting lines on the road and staying within the lane. Now, that, you know, doesn't work very well in many scenarios within Michigan when you have, right. you know, leaf in the fall or when you have snow. So we actually started working on this problem, last year. And our graduate student did a phenomenal job. Actually, we did a very early stage demo of the ability to drive autonomously on the snow. It's in a fence area, but it really attracted a lot of attention and truly shows.
It's in the president's speeches.
Yes. We're trying to stay away from politics, I guess. You know?
No, it's my speeches.
My
speeches. I use that as an example about how smart things are doing.
I heard about that, and appreciate the recognition. There was even some articles written about it, and
But if you think about the challenge for a moment of all of this, because we are very visual when we drive, and so the idea that you some sensor would find a line is really an extension of sight to drive.
Yes. Right?
Mm-hmm. And we all struggle in the winter. With our sight and getting the car in the right spot. And so it's really fascinating to me sort of how you use a different kind of sensor or combinations of technology that are really novel to be able to do what seems like a very simple task.
Absolutely. So this is what very interesting about this whole new area, because now we're really talking about different type of sensors, exactly what you mentioned. Right now one of the most interesting technology is based on laser. And this is a technology of the sensors known as LADARs, with first letter L as in laser. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you could think about it as the version of radar, but with using laser. The thing about LADARs, they are incredibly precise in mapping the environment and basically telling the vehicle how far it is from all the different objects that surround it. So if you have buildings, other vehicles, pedestrians, trees, anything you could imagine. So that technology actually is what driving a lot of these capabilities as we move forward in this area of autonomous vehicle. Of course, radars play a very significant role. And radars, traditionally been used for pretty basic stuff, for example, blind spot, detection type of, for vehicles and so on. But one of the really interesting things we're finding right now is that some of the sensor technology, such as the cameras and LADARs, they could actually fail under very challenging weather conditions, fog or heavy snow. So radars will serve as a very kind of robust safety net for detection of other objects. One of the really interesting problems we're working on at MSU is trying to actually get the radar to the level of capability of recognition of objects, such as vehicles and pedestrian, the same level we could recognize objects using cameras. And that problem is very, very challenging. And one of the wonderful things, MSU for decades have a very strong pedigree in the radar area, one of the top in the nation. And now it's even more top.
Radar and antennas.
Radar and antennas, exactly. So
when you're working on projects, I'm a brainstormer by trade. I love to sit around and think about different aspects. Would you say that the positive things that are coming out are solution-based, where you have an item that can solve problems, so then you go out and seek the problems that your solution can solve? Or are they problem-based, where you bring up problems and then go try to find the solution to fix the problem?
Excellent question, and it's really both ways. So we have, if you look at the potential benefits of autonomous driving, it's just really phenomenal. I mean, you could start from safety, where you could really save literally worldwide maybe about 1 million life a year. And you could talk about injuries, which we have, some of the estimates, just the U.S., you have about a minimum of 2 million a year of injuries due to human error, and, you know, that lead to crashes. Now, there is a huge economic ramification for this. The estimate's about $200 billion a year due to hospitalization, due to damages and property and, you know, vehicles and so on. So there is a whole set of benefits. And, of course, there is, benefits related to energy saving and things related to productivity and so on. So there is a whole laundry list, if you will, of benefits that we foresee that's going to happen. And frankly, they're very compelling. And that's a big driver for why autonomous driving is receiving so much attention. And now, of course, with that comes a lot of challenges. And that's also driving a lot of the problems we're looking at. I mean, you're looking at anywhere from how does the insurance industry going to deal with this? You know, we're going to move a whole different, you know, model in terms of, you know, how we're going to do, you know, the policy, the laws. That's just non-technical issues. And, of course, the technical issues are really also very profound, frankly. I think one of my favorite example is, you know, people talking about, you know, we're going to do better with autonomous driving than a human. I frankly believe strongly we have not even reached the level of competence of human driving yet. So we need, because we human are so good at recognizing our environment when we drive. One of the example that we could think of, if you're driving and you recognize there are pedestrians around you. Now, the industry right now in terms of autonomous driving, they're focusing on detecting pedestrians. However, we are not at the stage of actually distinguishing between, is this pedestrian an adult,
right,
or a child, right, that is walking by him or herself unattended? We humans recognize these situations very quickly, and we respond in the way we drive just naturally.
Right.
And we need to get to that level of...
Because there could be volatility in how they respond to the situation, and we can anticipate that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, a classical example, if you see a ball running across the street and you're going to step on the ball, now we immediately say, well, there is probably someone going to run after or chase after the ball, and we react to that and become very cautious. So we need to get that level of understanding and recognition of our environment.
This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. You're in the middle of a conversation on our mobility future in autonomous and connected vehicles with MSU engineering professor Haider Rida, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis.
If you were, you and I are talking, the three of us were doing an interview, let's say 5 years from now, and your dreams about connected vehicles, autonomous vehicles were coming true, what would the campus look like if we were thinking about that being sort of autonomous, connected vehicles? What would be different?
Excellent question. So I think right now there are, actually the year 2021 is a magic year. Why? Because in 2016, many announcements were made 5 years from 2016. So we anticipate there will be some level of autonomous vehicle around. Most of it could be in the form of ride-sharing, ride-hailing kind of technology. In fact, Ford made that announcement that they're going to make those kind of capabilities in autonomous vehicle in 2021. The capability would be in what's known as geofenced areas.
Mm-hmm.
So the vehicle really knows its environment, at least from the static point of view. It knows the buildings, knows the roads, knows the intersections. It knows the path pretty well. But then it needs to react, of course, to the dynamic aspects where you could have other vehicles, mm-hmm, and pedestrians and so on. So I could envision actually some of those capabilities, which is kind of in a geofenced area within the campus, let's say maybe the West Circle, maybe, you know, the East Circle, you know, some parts of the campus may have autonomous vehicles supporting maybe students and faculty, with some basic mobility services. Now, you know, the connected part actually could be also very compelling in terms of enabling a whole new host of mobility within the campus, in terms of even scheduling classes where it's kind of optimized around trying to minimize delays for students to go from one classroom to another. So there is possible. There are a lot of possibilities 5 years from now, but I think if we go beyond that, the possibilities would be even much more.
Do you have any trepidation being in an autonomous vehicle?
Frankly, this is the trillion-dollar question, maybe. So there is a big issue with acceptance. You know, how much really people are going to accept this technology, how much going to embrace it. My take on this, we're going to have a very diverse reaction and response to this technology. And in fact, we know now the millennials, you know, generation, they really do not prefer to drive. I mean, that's the least. And I think there will be a major group of population that's going to embrace this technology. I think, you know, once the technology is really demonstrated in a very robust and safe way, and, you know, people, if you think about what's going on with Tesla, I mean, Tesla is right now demonstrating a very basic level of autonomy. It's known as actually level 2, and what we're trying to get to is what's known as level 4. People, you know, buying Tesla and they use the autopilot despite the fact they know there is a possibility for, you know, fatal crashes. I mean, and they still, you know, do it. So I think there will be, you know, different segments of society that they will embrace the technology with different level of acceptance. And I think it's just going to be one of those things that, the whole society is going to get used to over the years and maybe over the next decade or two.
This is fascinating. I think, you know, as you look at so many transitions in life, there are things where people say, I'll never trust it, I'll never get there, and then they become almost the norm. It'll be interesting to watch when 2021 and beyond comes along that, I mean, the technology is there now, but the more it gets accepted, it really opens up your eyes of other possibilities beyond just transportation.
Absolutely. And if I may add, there is actually one study that published recently by McKinsey and Company. It predicts that by year 2030, we'll have about 15% penetration of autonomous vehicles. Now, 15% may sound like a small number, but actually if you consider by then, we might be approaching about 2 billion vehicles worldwide. So the number could be very large. Now, even if you just focus on the U.S., right now we have about 260 million vehicles on the road. So even if 15% still is pretty significant by 2030, this is actually going to be one of the most challenging aspects of this whole technology era, is that what we call it is really the transition. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're going to have this mix of vehicles driven by human, which are not connected and not autonomous. You know, some vehicles will be driven by human and they are connected, and there are some vehicles which are fully autonomous. That hybrid is going to be really very challenging, and it's going to take probably, frankly, maybe 2040 or so beyond until we have, you know, much more dominant autonomy.
Now, Michigan, because of Willow Run and the Planet M project, wants to be the epicenter of translating the very sophisticated research that you all are doing in the laboratory, the projects that our students are engaged in that hopefully they'll win internationally, with very practical problems, including large vehicles. So we've talked a little bit about cars, and most of the autonomous vehicles that you see right now are smaller cars, are not big cars. Tesla's not too small, but they're not. But there's also this place that people believe that trucks can really, and transportation can be enhanced by the equivalent of autonomous semi-trucks. And that there's a big interest at Willow Run in working in that area.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, the autonomous trucks type of, you know, movement, if you will, it's already taking place. And in fact, there has been some, testing and announcements of you know, having trucks, you know, driving platoons, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think Willaron would be a tremendous asset for the state of Michigan in terms of testing these different capabilities. And having the ability to actually go at highway speed is very pivotal in order to really fully test this technology. And, you know, adding complexities such as, and you know, trucks and even buses and, you know, other type of vehicles, you know, lightweight, medium weight, you know, other any kind of weight you could imagine. Again, that heterogeneity is also going to be very challenging. But the whole truck industry, actually, we have two industries which are maybe being under the radar in terms of they don't get the publicity they deserve in terms of being almost pretty autonomous, the mining industry and the farming industry.
Right.
And they've been actually pretty advanced in their autonomous capabilities. Of course, they're going to benefit a lot from all the new technologies being developed, you know, outside their industries. And that's going to be really very interesting. I mean, in fact, the study I was reading earlier this week, in fact, over the weekend, I should say, they were showing actually some of the benefits of using autonomous driving in those two industries, the mining industry and the farming industry. And there was a reduction in emission, carbon dioxide emission, by 60% just from using the vehicles in those two industries. Now imagine you take that benefit and you translate it to, you know, more than a billion vehicle around the world. Mm-hmm. I just said something triggered my mind when we were talking about this other industry.
Well, I've been in, you know, combines and other farm equipment where it sort of drives itself. I mean, you can literally program the computer and sit there and listen to music and read a book, and the thing will find the corners. It will figure out the right rows to hit. It takes soil temperatures. It takes conditions, so it adds a little bit more fertilizer here when it thinks it needs it. It's pretty remarkable, because it would take two or three passes sometimes to make each of those decisions independently. Mm-hmm. But right now you said there are convoys of trucks on the road that are semi-autonomous or autonomous?
They're called platoons. So this is something being
I want to know if I can find what would look like.
Well, the some of tests have already taken place in Europe, and I believe some of the you know well-known manufacturer like Mercedes and so on, they have been in fact you know kind of taking the lead in
but this. Autonomous doesn't necessarily mean not having a driver in the cab.
That's
the thing. It's like the tractor,
right? Absolutely.
And essentially, the farm example.
Absolutely.
People sit there because it's still not a perfect technology.
Absolutely.
And in the middle of it, the rain may start or something needs to be adjusted on the computer to make sure that we're doing it correctly.
Absolutely.
But it still means that you can work longer.
Absolutely.
You're much more efficient in your work. The machine can go longer, and because it's less tiresome for you in terms of attention spans.
Absolutely, and you know, this is one of the number one issue that we hear a lot about. You know, the trucking industry is that you know the drivers actually are very you know have a sleep deprivation, mm-hmm. and you know this kind of technology can really, you know, help them significantly. And, we always, you know, sometimes I get asked a lot, you know, do we have a human sitting behind the wheel or inside the vehicle? And I said, yes, absolutely, for many years to come. And I think, frankly, I'm one of the people who believe that even if we're going to have fully autonomous vehicle, I think manufacturers are going to have to give the choice mm-hmm. to consumers where they could drive manually or autonomously, and I think there'll be maybe
it's like autopilot on an airplane, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
So there'll be a substantial segment of society who would like to have that option, but then at the same time, you hear there'll be autonomous vehicle that doesn't have any steering wheels and you know no pedals and so on.
Are there offshoot industries that this technology people are thinking about? We have this for the vehicle world, mm-hmm. but as you get that technology built, we start thinking of things. It could be used here. It could be used there. I'm immediately thinking of the little robot that vacuums your carpet without.
Absolutely. In fact,
Or the one that mows your yard
for you. Mows your yard for you.
Yeah, there's even a bigger one now that would do a lot more space in your yard.
I saw something in Madison that is a it's like the size of a trash can, and it brings your food to you for lunch.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
Yep. Yeah.
But it's based on the same, a little bit cruder, but same technology, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. And, in fact, this whole area in humanoids, right? Mm-hmm. So in robotics, that robot that almost resemble a human in terms of their interaction, this is the area we're going to really benefit significantly from that overlap in terms of the technology. It's all about sensing your environment.
Right.
It's about recognition, understanding the need of people around you. Because one of actually the other interesting thing that we're working on at MSU, actually, which I forgot to mention, is we're really not only working on sensing the external environment of the vehicle. We're working on trying to sense and really address the need of the occupants of the vehicle. Now, we're not going to have drivers, but we're going to have people. I mean, envision a case where an occupant may get into a health emergency. The vehicle should be able to actually sense that and literally just drive that person maybe to an emergency room.
Sure.
Or, you know, maybe drive them to to the nearest pharmacy to take their blood pressure pill or whatever they need. So there are a lot of possibilities there.
So if you think about the way that you and your colleagues have put together Canvas, it's both connected and autonomous vehicles, having them talk to one another, networked and connected with their environment, not just connected as a vehicle, but connected to their environment. But the purpose is safety.
Right.
And understanding the human condition with that, which is very land grant, but also to give us a better understanding about how to build infrastructure around us.
Okay.
So it's not simply about the car.
Mm-hmm.
It's about all of the infrastructure that surrounds the car in order to be able to make it safer. And that could be a vehicle that looks just like a car today and has a driver and everything else. So it's not just for driverless vehicles. It's for all of us to benefit from that technology, even if we choose to have a steering wheel and pump our brake in the same way.
Absolutely. That's actually another very huge area, which is the area of infrastructure that's surrounding these autonomous connected vehicles, as you mentioned, will be really of great benefit even to manual vehicles. I mean, for many years, in fact, this technology that led to the connected vehicle standards around something known as DCRC, which stands for Dedicated Short-Range Communication, that could supply infotainment and information to vehicle. You could imagine now information becoming like a fuel station as you pass by, specific spots within the highway or in urban areas. You actually get some critical information that's helping you. Could be anywhere from a recommendation. This is the best place to park, so you don't have to worry about what is the optimum, minimum delay kind of parking for you, and so on. Of course, when we have autonomous vehicle, we don't have to worry about that because they'll park themselves. So,
well, it's really been, I think, exciting to have you and your colleagues who are part of Canvas here, but also this connection to our undergraduate students and graduate students in this national, international competition. I think many people don't always recognize Michigan State for being a place that is doing this very fundamental and yet practical work. And to have it recognized at the highest level for our students is just terrific. So thanks very much for being a part of Team MSU.
Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Mark wants to go ride in the car.
Anytime, Mark.
That was MSU engineering professor Haider Rida discussing our mobility future in autonomous and connected vehicles with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear the conversation again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today. And this is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. One of the things that drives me nuts about Facebook is how people complain about stuff there. Not that I'm against complaining. I actually love it. If there is a solution and the willingness to engage in creating that solution attached to it. It's hard to change the status quo on anything because entrenched organizations are just that, well-organized. They have someone in charge and a large infrastructure behind them that is well-paid to keep things as they are. They have studied the rules of the game, know their competition, have plans in place to protect their position. And here's the biggest factor. They are dedicated to the cause. If the past decade has taught us anything, it's that most people are basically comfortably numb, lethargic, and, short of complaining on Facebook, are unwilling to get in the game. Entrenched, well-organized operations count on this. They work harder and longer, knowing that most people won't go the distance to fight to the finish. In a pinch, they will give just enough to defang the opposition. But more likely, they will create a climate of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about change and spend lots and lots of time and money to protect their position. Effecting change takes time, commitment to the cause, and the willingness to lead. And it's risky. We tend to attack charismatic leaders we don't agree with. Take a strong position and your semi-comfortable existence is in danger. It's easy to become demoralized, intimidated, afraid, and it's very easy to give up. So the majority of us just let it ride. We'll yell at the TV, flame the social media comment sections, maybe even get some friends together for lunch for a group gripe. But we won't do anything meaningful with the intensity and tenacity it takes to effect change. So what's the flip side of all of this? Engage, organize, execute, be willing to take some punches, and keep on keeping on. One of my politician friends tells me, nothing frightens me more than a rational constituent on the other side of my argument. Occasionally there will be something that will so inflame enough people that change occurs, but that's rare. Change, wrote Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., does not roll on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle. And so we must straighten our backs and work for our freedom. A man can't ride you unless your back is bent. Margaret Mead's motivational chestnut has become a cliche, but it's still as valid today as it was when she first said it. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only way that it ever has. The enemy, your competition, the status quo is counting on the fact that you won't commit to do whatever it takes to get what you want. Will you? I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
WKAR. For listening to MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. To hear segments from today's show and more MSU Today content, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR.